everyone. I'd like to start this segment by welcoming the captain of the ship, Matt Wilson.
Thank you for having me today, sir.
So we missed getting to have you on last episode, but you have exciting things you want to talk about. What do you have coming up? The players want to know.
Don't I know it? Well, let's see. As you know, we've been working on a lot of different things. In fact, you're a big part of a lot of them yourself. But I think the big question on a lot of minds right now is what's coming up for War Machine?
I have no idea. Why don't you tell us?
Well, I've seen a few comments out there on the internet. We've had our head down working on stuff for a while, and we've been showing things off along the way. You've seen a whole new Orgoth faction, as well as new additions to Signar. And now we've even shown off a very compelling Kador character. And there's a whole lot more beyond that.
Oh, now, don't tease us, Matt. The Kador spoiler we showed on Primecast Plus caused a huge stir. When can we expect something new to drop? It's been quite a few months since anybody's gotten anything new for War Machine. When can we get our hands on something new?
When? Well, the reason for the gap in releases is that we're doing a lot of R&D into the future of how War Machine gets produced. We've had a lot of effort focused on War Machine over the past year, but I think there's a misconception that gets propagated out in the community that a lack of releases or information means that we're not concentrating any effort on War Machine. You know, as you know, that could not be further from the truth. The reality is, if we're quiet on something, we probably are working harder on it than ever. And beyond just developing new content for War Machine, we're working on a number of new challenges.
So what are some of the hurdles we've been facing?
So a huge one is that producing miniatures in metal has become almost impossible because of the rising costs of materials. Mm-hmm. At one point, we thought we might be headed back to plastics, but the current supply chain issues and our current experience with overseas manufacturing has compelled us to reevaluate that strategy. Plastic is very hard to keep stocked because of the minimum order quantities associated with its production. As we see all the time, we're feeling that now with several model kits that are currently out of stock. The problem is that when an initial run of plastic sells out, in order to restock it, you have to order a ton more. But when we know we're only going to sell a fraction of that minimum order quantity, then we're staring down a loss in order to reorder them. So this makes plastic an undesirable option for the future, and we're looking at other means.
Interesting. Are we doing anything to combat this issue?
Yes. We've been doing a ton of experimentation and research into different production methods that we can handle internally so that we're not hampered by supply chain issues like that in the future.
It's never easy when the logistics of your product is also dependent on the need for materials and tooling. I am glad to hear, though, that we're finding creative solutions around it. So what does this mean for Orgoth? Are we kickstarting the new faction?
Are we kickstarting Orgoth? No. Several months ago, we thought that might be the route because we were still looking at the possibility of producing them in plastic. But with our concerns about keeping things in stock, we've ruled that out as an option. Plus, we want to see them on the tabletop sooner than later, and plastics have a very long production cycle. So we're looking at a more traditional release for them, hopefully with a pre-release at a big event in the very near future.
Only big event on my future radar right now.
Gen Con, yes. So that's what we're aiming for. But it depends on how we determine the best method of production for them, both on quality and on maintaining a reasonable price for them. If everything goes well, we'll see Orgoth on the tables before the end of summer. And we may even see some of the other things that we've been working on following quickly behind. We've got several Storm Legion models in the queue, as well as a couple of Kador models like Captain Boris Yuk.
That's really cool. I am super excited to get those models on the table and play. I know we have been showing off a ton of models. The Storm Legion looks amazing. The new Bison looks amazing. People are really hyped up to get their hands on those models.
I am so excited to see them go out into the world. I know the War Machine community is thirsty for new content. We've been working on it, and pretty soon we're going to be able to open the floodgates.
All right. So War Machine releases are close at hand, but what else? We do have a Kickstarter coming up. No, it launched today. So mind we segue into that before we have you go?
You know I want to talk about it.
So Nightmare Empire. This is a really exciting place for players to adventure, and we are providing them a number of awesome player aids to go with it. We also have Matt Goetz joining me on a later segment to talk about some of the exciting things they can get into as well.
That's right. We've got three new books that expand the setting. For the first time ever, we're diving deep into the Dark Heart of Krix and detailing everything about the Shard Islands. This whole expansion is devoted to pirates, the undead, and basically anything that starts with Necro. But I'm sure Matt Goetz will have a lot more to say and be a lot more interesting.
Yar. Is there something in this Kickstarter you are particularly excited for players to get their hands on?
Well, it's exciting just to get to detail out this area of the Iron Kingdoms that we've never done in the RPG before. But like the Borderlands Kickstarter campaign, we've also incorporated new miniatures into our stretch goals. And there are some really exciting models that make both great villain NPCs as well as possible PCs that we're doing for this campaign.
What are the important dates for this Kickstarter? I know this is one thing I always struggle with Kickstarters, and having them out, you know, time and time again, that's how I remember them.
So it's going to run from today until 5 p.m. on July 21st. And there's an awesome early bird reward for anybody backing in the first 72 hours. The early birds get an exclusive dragon coin, which is based on a coin in the setting. And it makes a great inspiration token while you're playing the game. But as well, it's going to have some real world benefits. Like if you present it at a convention where a privateer has a booth, you'll get a discount on any purchases. And there might even be other exclusive swag that it nets you.
Ah, that's crazy. It's like a secret draconic membership.
For our most ardent supporters, yes, we truly appreciate everyone who helps our projects come to life, and we want to make sure that support is rewarded.
You know, in the military, they always have these like coin challenges, and there are enough privateer coins out there. I'd be dying to meet somebody at a convention and be like, challenge, and throw down like an old Menoth coin, and then slap down a dragon coin on top of it, and it's like, I think you outrank me on that one. That's a expensive coin.
You would lose.
Yep, I lost. But those kind of things are exciting. I love the culture around coins. I think it's really cool. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you were to make an IKRPG character in the Nightmare Empire right now, what would you make and why?
Iron Lich Pirate, full stop. Basically, a 60th in a pirate hat. I don't think I'm alone in this.
Nice. That's amazing. So this one's tough for me. If we were playing a good aligned campaign, full on Midnight Paladin all the way, just go in there, you know, smashing some undead, smite this, smite that, a little bit of shield action. But if we're playing an evil campaign, I've always wanted to play an Iron Lich too. I think, you know, from the get go, Iron Lich, maybe in some kind of like cool dragon Turok body.
Yeah. See, everybody wants to go Iron Lich.
It's just a cool Iron Kingdom setting. I'm not going to lie. So what is the one thing in the Nightmare Empire you would never want to go toe-to-toe with?
Just one thing? How about everything? I couldn't go toe-to-toe with a powder skig, much less anything with Thrall in its name. So Warcasters, Deathjack, I mean, what would you run from?
I'll pass on ever meeting a Brine Thrall. Mechano Shark is a big no for me.
We've got a healthy fear of open water before you even introduce anything like a Necro Shark. Real sharks scare the bejesus out of me.
Oh, me too. I'm, you know, sharks are cool to look at from a distance and a tank and an aquarium. That's it. That's all you're getting from me.
Yeah, that's as close as I want to get.
Thank you, Matt, for joining me on this segment of Primecast to talk about the Iron Kingdom's Nightmare Empire expansion coming up and a lot of the things going on in the War Machine world. Just to remind everybody that Nightmare Empire Kickstarter is going to be running until July 21st.
Roll drums.
And we're back with Matt Goetz in this segment to talk about Nightmare Empire. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing pretty good.
I am hyped. I'm glad to have you back. You're one of my favorite guests to talk to. We always have lots of fun stuff to talk about. And Nightmare Empire, right?
Heck yeah.
So hyped. So with the Kickstarter basically right on top of us, we have some things we're going to cover and talk about today. We wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that we showed you on the last Primecast Plus. So on last Primecast Plus, you got to look at the Scoundrel's Guide cover. You got to look at the Blackwater Cantina, Tales from the Blackwater Cantina. So now we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then as we're going through this, feel free to go back and check out some of those images. And maybe we'll give you a little new frame of reference on it. And then at the end, if we have time, Matt and I are going to dive into a little character creation and talk about some of our favorite characters.
That sounds like fun.
All right, Matt. So why don't you lead us off with a little bit about the Scoundrel's Guide?
Absolutely. For people who had the previous Kickstarter, we did the Survival Guide to the Borderlands. It was a sort of companion book to Borderlands and Beyond that introduced some optional new rules, a bunch of monsters, magical items, and stuff like that. You can think of the Scoundrel's Guide to the Shard Islands as sort of the Nightmare Empire version of that book. It introduces new rules that are unique to kind of the maritime and seafaring nature of the Shard Island. So you've got awesome things like, yeah, uh, you've got a sort of stripped down, more narrative naval combat that allows you to get in with your ships and do boarding actions.
Oh, snap. I love naval combat.
Oh, man. Naval combat is such a big part of the setting that I'm glad to have a tool to just kind of do a quick sea battle with your games of Requiem.
You know, the title to the last time you were on Primecast, the whole episode, we called it something, something, something ship combat, I think.
Yeah, we did. We did. No, it was just teasing because it was one of the more exciting pieces of The Scoundrel's Guide, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It also includes maritime hazards. So what happens if you run aground on a coral reef or get caught in a maelstrom or those semi-mystical Meridius whirlpools that can take an entire Dirgen Mass ship and drag it down to the bottom. Kind of like the perils of disease and the hazards and stuff that were in the Borderlands Survival Guide. We're doing that with The Scoundrel's Guide.
As and then if on top, brine thralls weren't enough to worry about.
Oh, man. Worry about a brine thrall when you're trapped in a capsized boat, right? But it also has some unique Crixian and Shard Island magic items, some that are really weird and fun. Some new monsters like the Brine Thrall and Bloodhounds and Dragon Knights and a bunch of other stuff that you haven't seen before. Plus,
Dragon Knights.
For Dragon Knights, imagine a man of war that is a crazy devout worshiper of the Dragon Father. They're not undead, but they're 1 foot in the grave, you know? They're infested by Necrotite. They've got these Necrotite-powered suits of armor and some pretty interesting kind of mystical focuser abilities. You can almost use them like arc nodes. They're great.
Oh my God, I love it so much. That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is sick. Concept, nose to tail. That's a character I'd play. Let me get that mini.
Yeah, right. So we're exploring a lot of different areas because, the Shard Islands are vast, right? You have an uncountable number of these little islands scattered across. So we provided a generator to just rapidly make a new one that your characters can go happen across with its own quirks and oddities and inhabitants and stuff.
Make your own archipelago. That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. There are a couple of monster types in the book that instead of being a specific monster, because there's so much blight that twists and warps things around Crix, we have the blighted insects, for instance. Ooh, but
that's
when absolutely. When you create one of these swarms, you've got a table of primary and a table of secondary characteristics to make them a little bit different from one another. So you could have, flying tarantulas that have acidic venom or whatever. But there's also the blighted wildlife. There are three major kinds of them. There's the leaper, the wallower, and the charger. And they're just meant to represent kind of a broad spectrum of beasts that have been modified by dragon blight to become these really violent, really weird creatures. And they also have those two tables where you start with a base, a wallower. So imagine an elephant seal or something, but then you roll on a primary characteristic table to see what its major blight mutation is. And then a secondary for what its secondary blight mutation is. So you can really have a diverse range of monsters to throw at people when they go on expeditions, go safarying into the jungles of the Shard Islands.
That's awesome. It'd be a great way to create your own monsters too, right? Because you're okay, I want this guy to be, lethal, and I want him to be venomous, so I'm going to make him look like a snake and a spider. And
yeah, that's why we chose kind of roles for their descriptor instead of saying this is a blighted water buffalo. Because it could happen, who knows? But with the leaper, right? I was thinking of a sleek, dexterity-based, agile, stealth predator. Mm. Whereas the charger is just brute force and strength that has a trampling attack and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But what the skin those things have hanging on them, that's entirely up to the game master. So you could have your face hugger giant boa scorpion or whatever else, right? The Shard Islands allows for a great diversity of weird.
Well, that's right on my alley. I like a diversity of weirdness.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I think that is plenty about the Scoundrel's Guide, but we haven't even touched on Tales from the Blackwater Cantina.
We haven't. people who've been familiar with the setting for a long time might remember that back in the previous editions, they had like those locations of note in areas like Blackwater. One of my favorites in there was this dirty dive bar on the docks of Blackwater called the Lamprey's Kiss. It's run by a kind of unscrupulous bartender named Kofi Hatrod. And like, I think we're pretty close in age. Did you ever read those old Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina Star Wars books?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have a whole chest of old Star Wars books, canon and non-canon. So go ahead, lay it on me.
It's canon and legends now, I think. But anyway, I loved those. I loved having a bunch of different stories that were kind of hung around just a conceptual skin. And there's nothing more classic role-playing than kicking off your character's career in like a bar.
Right? Oh yeah, absolutely. The tavern.
So Tales from the Blackwater Cantina isn't like we've done before where we had Legend of the Witchfire, Shadow of the Seeker, where there are these longer single campaigns. Instead, this book is four adventures. Each one is designed for a different level of play. So the very first one that you start with, Dead Men Tell No Tales, starts you in the Lamprey's Kiss, and it's meant to be like an introduction for people to play new Crixian characters.
Nice.
Or, you know, characters from the Shard Islands who wound up there or from there. But then the following three each are built around a different tier of gameplay, where there's one set in Dregsmouth that's more appropriate for like 5th to 10th level characters. And then one that takes place near Drakarung and Garlgast, and it's better for the next level of play, the next tier of play.
Nice.
And the fourth one in the set is meant to be for people at like that upper tier, and it takes place in Skell, the home of Torak.
Ooh. You got to be a special kind of person to enter there too.
Yeah, right. Which is why it's at that like 17 to 20th level tier of play. But they're each self-contained independent adventures that you can create new characters for and run from the beginning to the end. Or if you want a longer campaign that sort of builds out the full life of a character from 1 to 20, then you can do that too. You could take these four as sort of like the touchstone adventures for your characters and use the tools in the Scoundrel's Guide to fill in with a bunch of other adventures to help them get those level ups they need before they're ready to jump into the next story in Tales from the Blackwater Cantina.
It's also a great way to sideline a campaign. Like sometimes your characters, you know, they want to make their own choices, go their own path. And as a game master, you just have to adapt. And so a great way to adapt is like, well, you're in the Shard Islands now.
Yeah.
Here's the Lamprey's Kiss.
But I mean, there's a really useful tool for people wanting to bring characters from the mainland into the Shard Islands.
Oh, and, tell me and about that's, that.
Well, I mean, it exists in War Machine, right? It's the Pressgangers.
Oh, nice. The
Pressgangers are finding people who are too drunk in Clocker's Cove and Five Fingers and hitting them with a belaying pin. And then next thing you know, you're on a boat headed for Blackwater, right? Like,
nice.
Unscrupulous Pirates is sort of the underlying recurring theme of all of these books.
Oh, I could see it too, right? Like there are so many ways for characters to get abducted in the Iron Kingdoms. Like you just show up at the wrong dinner party and you wake up in, you know, the Shard Isles and you're like, what do we do?
There are also reasons that people might want to choose to go there, right? Like,
yeah.
Before the OG Witchfire started, the Inquisitor Dexter Serac actually went to Castle Morcraig in Crix because that's where the Witchfire was. It was in this old Pirate King's ruined domain. And until you see the kind of weird magic items that we've got coming up for this one, like there's a lot of reasons people would want to go treasure hunting out there because it's full of weird stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And all the loot that they take back there as pirates themselves, you know.
The very first adventure in Tales from the Blackwater Cantina is kind of a little love letter of mine to Treasure Island, right?
Oh,
I love
nice.
These old classic pirate stories, so
I'm a sucker for the classics. I was just referencing Jules Verne the other day. So
20,000 Leagues Under Meridius.
Yeah,
I can see it.
Absolutely. So you're right there. You're talking my love language, man. So speaking of love languages, let's talk about character creation, because I feel like this is the aspect of every game, every campaign that the most love, the most time goes into. And this is something that we have allowed a lot of diversity in with this expansion.
Yeah. And like allowing people to play characters that step outside sort of the shackles of narrative has been and continues to be one of our big internal conversations among all the writers, right? Just to give you a for instance, the Satixis are going to be a PC option in Nightmare Empire. But when we were sitting down, like, we were trying to figure out, okay, we know every Satixis that has ever been depicted is a woman because of the blood of Shazkiz the White Dragon and what we've said in the past about the men like wasting away and the women being blighted and growing horns and all that. And it's like, how do we feel about that statement now? Like, what kinds of caveats do we want to give to it? What kind of exploration are we willing to do around that concept, right? And we went through that with every single option that we considered. Like, we don't want to leave anyone out in the cold. We don't want anyone to feel like they're not able to sit down at the table and play the character they want to play, you know? So there have been some considerations going into all of the different options, like beyond the Bogren and Gobbers and humans that are out in the Shard Islands. You know, we wanted to figure out, when you're playing a Revenant character, one of these physical undead characters, you know, your Bane, your Deathbound Revenants, or even Scarlocks are a playable option. You know, Scarlocks are traditionally bound to the will of their creator. So instead of making it something where you feel like you lose agency, we gave you a little bit of boost to represent that investment from your creator, but you're still an independent acting player character, right? We talked a little bit about the Satixis and what the Blight of Shazkiz means. The Shard Ogryn, how are they different from their mainland counterpart? What values do they have? And some of what we talk about there is like the touch of blight gives them advantage on saving throws against like poison and disease and resistance to a couple of other damage types. They don't have the like sworn Khorun option from the other Ogryn that you see on the mainland, because those Ogryn have a choice of who they think their boss is. Whereas in the Shard Islands, and especially on Krix, your boss is Torek, like full stop. He's the Khorun above all Khoruns, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that you could play things like the Revenant crew of the Atramentis or Blackbane's Ghost Raiders, Pistol Wraiths, and the types of mutations and blight aspects that the Blighted Troll can have. Like, it runs the gamut. Pretty much everything that you've seen in War Machine for the Krixian faction or the mercs that are more pirate-related, like the Devil Shadow Mutineers, for instance. Like, we tried to find a way to give you the option to play along with all of those concepts, and it was a monumental task on the part of the writers, and I'm very impressed by what they were able to do. I'm very proud of the team for the options they brought out. And like, there are only two new classes in Nightmare Empire, but I don't think that's a downside, because they both introduce something really different, really like fresh and fun. Like the Blood Witch, for instance, uses blood magic. If you've played a gun mage before, you might see a little conceptual overlap, but they function differently. But the Blood Witch, you know, it can represent your Satixis Blood Witches, but we also mention in it, like, hey, guess what? This is the groundwork if you want to play a Tharn Bloodweaver, if you want to play a Bloodrunner for the Scorn, right? Like, we're giving you the architecture for that right now, and when we hit those things later on with new subclasses that are a little bit more close to their interpretations of it, then you're already familiar with how the class works.
Nice.
Yeah.
I think It's really interesting to get into some of these characters' heads too. One of the really interesting things about undead is that to some degree, I mean, there are so many different types of undead, but one of the things that really make a resurrected body is that there is some kind of soul or something put back into that vessel that animates it. And to me, I've always seen that as some kind of free will, some kind of agency. Even the Scarlocks out there need to be able to look around and cast spells and make decisions and such. But it is what impels them to do those things, you know, whether it be the will of Torok or, you know, for us, I mean, we're impelled to eat. That's just something we have to do every day. So
yeah, absolutely.
I've always seen these undead characters where it's, you know, fulfilling something that they just have to do. And that's
yeah.
like, that driving force.
Yeah. And, you know, there have been in the fiction for War Machine before and in the setting, you know, you've got a Scarlock who's in charge of an entire ship in the Black Fleet, right? Mm-hmm. You've got Cortesh and Sun Eater, who are basically like the lieutenants of the host of Tartarus, who were like the left and right hand men of Gorshade. So just because they're undead doesn't mean that they're shackled to anyone necessarily.
Those characters too. I'm going to need the stats for that.
Cortesh and Sun Eater. We'll see how the crowdfunding goes. Maybe we can get some stretch goals for iconic undead NPCs to throw at people.
That would be so amazing. It's not the first time talking about Sun Eater, right? And you, as a Crix player, you talk about some of these characters that don't exist in the game yet, and you're like, oh my gosh, what would this person or that person be like?
Sun Eater is definitely one of the more memorable Bane warriors in fiction. Cortesh, I think he gets a little bit of short shrift just because his name isn't as easy to remember. But I like what we've been doing with the RPG, mining through the old fiction, older editions, newer War Machine and Hordes material in order to create kind of this whole picture of the IK, this gestalt that pays respect to our roots. Like, there are some things that I've been bringing back in the monster entries that for the longest time were just something in the old 3.5 edition that you'd never seen again. Like the old Dolomite becoming the Rockhound, right? I love doing that. I love those little touches on nostalgia, reminders of the things that got all of us into this setting, into these games in the first place, right?
Absolutely. I want you to tell me what character you were going to create right now. Just on the spot. I'm going to put you on the spot. I want you to make me a character from that is, say this is the character that's going to show up in the Lamprey's Kiss.
Okay. If I'm going to create a character right now, I don't typically play spellcasters. Like, you know, I'll play clerics, but those are healing on a stick with some divine weapon options. I think for this one, I would want to go a Shard Ogryn. And just because they're fun, right? You get the big bruiser character, but to play against type, I would go with one of the new mechanic subclasses. There's the Ironmonger, which is sort of like the Shard Ogryn archetypical class. I'm not going to go with that. I think I'm going to go with the Necrotech. It has a class feature that allows you to build scrap thralls that are just living bombs.
Yes.
But there are a lot of really interesting
Come
things.
Get a hug that, from my scrap thrall.
Right? Like, my scrap thrall has Death Burst.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm going to start him at first level, obviously, and build into Necrotech once I get my archetype choice. But once I have the ability to start, you know, pumping out these scrap thralls, I'm going to create, like, custom mega scrap thralls using the thrall creation rules in the Scoundrel's Guide. So they're a little bit tougher, they're a little bit faster, maybe. I don't know. But I think that's where I'm going to start. A Shard Ogryn Iron, or not Ironmonger, Shard Ogryn Necrotech with an eye on creating the perfect unliving bomb as his little buddy.
Sick. Well, I said it earlier in the cast, Dragon Knight for me. Check, please.
Dragon Knight?
Dragon Knight. Yeah.
There are so many interesting options for the subclasses in here. Like, you've got your Mariner Warcaster or the Soul Weaver Wizard, the Dirge Seer for the Sorcerer, Warwitch Siren, which, like, I know what you're thinking. It's not. The Warwitch Siren's actually a rogue archetype that is able to pull off sneak attack damage bonuses in a new way. The Necrosurgeon, even some like non-Crixian stuff, like Knights of the Vigil, the Signarin Knightly Order that watches the shoreline against Crixian incursion. The Seafarer Ranger, right? The Oath Undying, or the Way of the Dying Hand Monk. Like, there are so many weird things in here.
The Way of the Dying Hand, also known as what I get when I write too much on my keyboard.
Right.
Okay. Well, that was a lot to talk about. We got a lot of amazing topics packed in. Any parting shots? Anything you want to say on the way out?
Just that we're going to be going into crowdfunding really soon. Mm-hmm. We have some great early bird specials, including the Dragon Coin, which is another one of those nostalgic throwbacks. Because that was in the old World Guide, I think, was when it was first mentioned. That was, what, 2004? And we have some fun new add-ons in the form of, like, maps. And it may sound a little weird, but some Shard Island postcards that you're going to want to get your hands on. There's a lot of great stuff coming with the Kickstarter, which is, like, right around the corner.
That's exciting. I can't wait. Make sure to sign up for the mailing list through Privateer Press so that you can be the first notified of when it goes live, and join us for the Kickstarter. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this segment. And we are going to talk about Monsterpocalypse. One of the most exciting things about this right now is that I have brought on two of the playtesters, Marin and Brett. Marin and Brett.
Hi, I'm Marin.
Hey, I'm Brett.
And they're going to each pick one of the new release sides from the agendas, the Protectors or Destroyers, and they're going to tell us a little bit about their thoughts on it coming out of playtest and into the actual world, give you a little behind the curtain look at some of the synergies and thoughts that are expected. We're going to talk about some of their lists that they might want to play with the models they expect, and give you some of that feel good game shop hangout that everybody loves and misses. And so first up, we're going to dive into Protectors, and on the slate for the new Protectors, we're going to have Avervinia with the Vegetyrants, and she is kind of the final chapter, the third and final piece. And with her, she's going to bring a couple new unit packs. And so Brett has brought a list today. Brett, why don't you tell us about your Avervinia list?
Sure. So I took Avar and I paired her up with the Warden of Teokali.
Tell me about those two.
Yeah, so they're both monsters that care a lot about buildings, right? Warden has the whole repair package going on, and Avar's got Integrate, which, like, really lets you turbocharge kind of the value of all your buildings.
Okay, so what are some of the buildings you'd expect to have in your Avar Warden of Teokali list?
So there's, like, the classic three, the Mount Terra, the ISB, and the Industrial Complex that, like, I'll never leave home without.
So what's the ISB stand for?
The Imperial State Building, sorry. And so, like, that's just kind of, like, where I start all my list building. From there, there's two things that I think, like, both of these monsters kind of want, which is, like, cool techie buildings. So I brought an Outreach Center so that I have, like, some weird access to transform so I can kind of, like, swap around what my units are doing. The Reclamation Facility, I think, is almost a must include with any Integrate monster. And same with the UCIs.
So why is that?
So with her ability to copy a building action within two of her, it gives her, like, a fake screen clear right from the hop.
For anybody who's just getting into Monsterpocalypse, a screen clear is the ability to remove a unit or her building sometimes from the equation that it might be blocking the enemy monster down. There are a lot of maps that can be very technical with how you place your monsters and buildings and then units to protect yourself from getting body dunked into a building. And so with Integrate, one of the cool tech things is that she can reach into a reclamation facility and use its ability to recycle a unit nearby and eat that unit, so get it out of the way, and then also get some power from it along the way, which is really cool. And there's a whole bunch of buildings that have really neat interactions that Avervenia can integrate into and do something with. What was the other one you mentioned?
So it's the UCI. And the reason for that is because of, like, there's a weird little interaction with UCI and Integrate, which is the UCI has an ability that gives it the action of every other building on the map. It has to do its action to take advantage of those usually, but the Integrate monsters just means that they've got this one little central point where they can then copy everything.
I like the idea of little Vine in there punching keys, like on the supercomputer. Beep, boop, boop, boop. And it's like, I like this building action. I think I'll take it. And then it comes in and like whispers in her ear and it's like, Avervenia, use the reclamation facility. And she's like, that's a good idea, Vine. That's how that went.
Painted quite the word picture. I'm entranced.
Fantastic. So reclamation facility, UCI Industries, and there are a ton of other ones. One of the other great synergies that I see in your list going over it here is that you have the world clock, so you can rebuild things a little faster. So there's definitely that repair synergy in there. And then if you bring the faction building, the world tree, you can flip over tiles using the world tree to make it easier for Teokali to repair something for Avar to reach into. So enough about buildings. Obviously, these monsters are very building-centric, and they give you a lot of synergy there. But there's more to it than that. We got a really interesting unit release with this pack of Vegetyrants, and they have some good synergy with the First Guardians.
Yeah, getting access to the Humasoid. So we've got aggressive on both sides now, means that protectors get to do all that really cool, cheaty stuff that destroyers have been doing for the last couple months.
Marin, you want to break down all the cool, cheaty stuff that destroyers have been doing for the last couple months as our destroyers aficionado and how it pertains to this Humasoid package here?
For sure. So destroyers have had a unit with the aggressive special rule, which basically once a turn when you spawn a unit with the aggressive rule, you can move it, meaning that you don't need to bump spawn it. And then we have another unit called the juror in destroyers, which has the special rule quorum, which essentially means that the juror counts as two units when checking to see whether a building is secured. And what that means in combination is that with these two units, you can secure usually a faction base during the spawn phase of the turn, which makes it much easier to make use of the discount abilities on those bases to get more and more units on the table, which is something that's going to be really important when we get back to me, but is something that, of course, the protectors would love to be able to do as well.
Absolutely. There are a ton of great little combos being able to secure a building in your spawn phase. One of my favorites is to early secure the industrial complex. So right out the gate, no matter where you need to move, you're going to have that plus one speed and then kind of jump off from there.
Yeah, that's a good use because you can then like move off the industrial, take the speed bump like for when you need it, and then secure more valuable buildings.
Are there any other synergies within your list, Brett, that you want to talk about and, you know, bring to the light here?
Well, I think there's like kind of a cool, not super obvious interaction between the Whomping Nettle and the Temple Monolith.
Oh, tell us about it.
Yeah, so with the Whomping Nettle having Ambush Hunter to get it plus two boost if it doesn't move and reach, you can use it to spawn off a spawn point or be bumped off a spawn point into position on some junk that your opponent's put in your back line, and then use a Temple Monolith in combination with Nettle and a Carnadon or some other source of good blues to have a really safe attack to clear that junk by attacking it. And when you combine that with Avar also having Urban Renewal, it means that you can clear a lot of junk out of your back line and get more impactful buildings for Integrate, or in for this list with the Warden as well.
Absolutely. You can do some building shuffling very early on with Urban Renewal on the Temple Monolith, that Ambush Hunter reach. You can get some right off the jump attacks on some of these buildings that are safe and that, you know, it's going to get rid of the cathedrals that your opponent puts in your backline that require that devotion for an extra secure. It's going to help get rid of some of those media companies that are going to give your opponent power dice when they're in your backline and you're using actions. And so this is actually a great way with no actions involved to get rid of a media company.
Speaking of actions, there's a synergy that I noticed in your list as well that's really cool. And that's the combination of Providence and Integrate. Providence is a rule on the Warden of Teocalli that allows you essentially to anytime any model in your list attempts to perform an action, if that action costs one or more action dice, which are the little white ones that are that you're going to be moving around most of the time, you get to roll that and maybe get it back. And if you're really lucky, get a power die as well. With Integrate, that gives you a monster who has a ton of actions, not just one or two that might be listed on other monsters. And the unit list that you've brought, you've already mentioned several units that have actions associated with them, so you can get even more value out of it that way.
It's like fish for those red dice, right?
Absolutely.
Well, and, you know, speaking of synergy, we can, you know, we're wrapping it back up here to the monsters. Having alignment on the Warden of Teocalli enables Avervinia to do a lot of the things that she wants to do even better. If you're getting that bonus dice for your buddy, like Avervinia loves a boost dice to be able to more accurately punch those defense seven buildings. It's less resources you have to invest. And in the end game, when you're trying to do a very efficient attack that leads to putting your opponent into the very specific building you have summoned up for them, it's important that you can do so and still have all the resources available to you, all the power dice available to you to be successful.
Yeah, like especially with the hyper, right, when we're talking combo striking, because we've got envelop too. So like a bonus boost plus envelop makes that attack like super safe, right? It brings her up to a 6 boost, which is where the dice math gets super easy, especially into a 7. You do pay for it by having no like conventional 1v1, but trade.
This is true. This is very techie. This is very like, you know, outplay, outsurvive, you know, outmaneuver your opponent on the list. So, Marin, you brought a destroyer's list on the other side of things, and our new destroyer's monster is Zor Necros, who was formerly Zor Macros, necrified by the Necroscourge, and he's bringing his own units into the fold with the Necros Overlord and the Necros Shinobi.
I certainly did, and the cool thing about Zor Necros is that wherever he ends up at the end of your turn, it's going to cost you some dice, but you're going to be able to put out one of those Necro Shinobi, which means we talked about de-screening tools that the protectors have. This is an extremely powerful screening tool that the destroyers now have access to. That ability is called Redshift. And because it's such an expensive ability, specifically, it's going to cost you power dice. I'm bringing along the biggest power dice battery that the game has to offer and the first destroyers monster ever released. You know him. You love him. It's Gorgadra.
God goes wild or is screaming. We're not sure.
I'm bringing Gorgadra to sort of facilitate, or more accurately, to reduce the impact that all of the power dice that I'm going to wind up spending on Redshift is going to have to protect Zor Necros. Gorgadra also likes to come with a partner who is difficult to go to attack, because Gorgadra really does want to be here for a good time and not a super long time. Really wants to be your first monster to die in a lot of cases. It's also another good way that these models will sort of interact. But the main fun stuff that's happening is in the unit list.
Absolutely. And I think there's a good tie back to the monsters from the unit list. So why don't you go over some of the spiciness in the unit list and how it ties back to the monsters?
So with Zor Necros and his tiny minions coming out this month, we get the last unit package for the Necroscourge, which the Necroscourge are a faction that is near and dear to my heart because they spam units like nobody's business. What I have listed here is sort of the hardest you can go into the Necroscourge without making an entire 20 unit list out of them. It's running basically two of every Necroscourge unit. So that's two Blade Revenants, two Hurling Swarms, one Hex Chantress Grunt, one Hex Chantress Elite. I'm actually running three Void Maulers, mostly because you get three in the pack anyway, and they're really good.
Yeah.
Two Necros Shinobis, which you're mostly going to be getting out through that Redshift ability, and the Necro and two of the Necros Overlords. Now, it is worth noting, these guys are incredible. They buff your units. They buff your monsters, which is just absolutely wild. They make it so that everything in your list that's near them gets to hit harder, which is really important because one of the things that the Necroscourge unit game can suffer against is really tough units. I'm talking about units like the Propo Walker, units like the Crawler, units that have defense four or high defense and it's some sort of defensive tech like Disruption on the Propo Walker. By bringing the Necros Overlord, you can reduce the impact of those defensive abilities and actually hit the enemy units, which allows you to make another Necroscourge unit, which because the repurpose rule doesn't come with manufacturer's limitation on being able to attack again, can then attack and make another Necroscourge unit, which brings us to why we call this unit package very lovingly the Clown Car, because you spawn one unit and you get five.
Yeah, there's some balancing factors to the Necroscourge in that they are a faction of synergy, and so there's a lot of overlapping abilities where, for the most part, they're all very squishy. Defense two, you have the Void Mauler who's out there providing hunker to the other Necroscourge that you're making. It has a really good strong attack to back up, you know, the whole Necroscourge package. And a lot of what they want to do also is about combining attacks. You know, the Blade Revenant wants to get out there, drop a Hurling Swarm so that you can have the repurpose chain going, and the two of them punch something and make something. And the Necroscourge Nexus helps with that by giving an extra boost die and Fury to really start kicking off that chain. And the Fury helps because that's more power dice for Zor Necros to be pumping out Necro Shinobi. I think there's some really amazing synergy with the Necroscourge package and Gorgadra specifically, though. Do you want to talk about that, Marin?
Yeah, so the other reason you want Gorgadra to be taking a lot of damage early is because Gorgadra gets a truly wonderful ability in Hyper called Unearthly Rage.
One of the best in the game.
Yes, definitely one of the best abilities in the game. What Unearthly Rage does is it gives all of your units and your other monster, and technically also Gorgadra, but Gorgadra has the rule already, the Riled Rule. And what the Riled Rule does is it says, anytime this model takes damage or is destroyed, you get a power die, which means all of these units that you've been spamming onto the table all game, suddenly destroying them just gives you dice anyway.
Oh, it's so
gross. That can fuel Zor Necros' redshifts. That can fuel Zor Necros' powerful attacks because he has some... His hyper has some powerful rules that allow you to really control the battlefield, but he needs the power dice to actually pull them off. And Gorgadra, especially when Gorgadra's in hyper, if you get that magic moment of both of your monsters in hyper, can just absolutely be that engine of power dice to do that for you.
Well, and if you get Gorgadra in hyper first, and you're providing out that Unearthly Rage, which, I mean, this is best case scenario for you, you've got Zor Necros, who's playing like that classic, you know, Saturday morning cartoon villain, who's like standing back, ha, 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 you know, pointing at the enemy, and like spamming little dudes in the way that all go out there and fight. And with Unearthly Rage now, if Zor Necros is screened, like we had talked about, you know, having that key unit that is there in the way, those Necro Shinobi have disruption, so make him harder to get at. And then just destroying them is going to fuel back his ability to retaliate with the crackback. And one of the really neat things about Zor Necros is if he does go hyperverse, if your opponent decides, I'm not going to mess with all the power in the world, well, let's go after Zor Necros first. Gravity is got to be the most enabling ability in the game.
Yeah, so gravity is a new rule. Anyone who's played a game with me knows I love Yasheth, who is a monster with a rule called drag. Now imagine if you could have that drag rule hit someone, pull them around the map, but you don't have to be next to them for it to happen. And that's what gravity is. Gravity lets you shoot a monster and move them up to three spaces, completely rewriting the battlefield in your favor. Now, as a cost to this, Necros is not let's say, the most accurate monster in the world. So that's what I mentioned. You really do need the ability to hit with that attack. And then if your other monster isn't on the table, you then need the dice to make the attack with Necros. And so it's because you're not getting any dice back from the gravity trigger is the main downside to it. But as a little bit of a reward, if he does hit with that gravity gun, go ahead and shuffle one of his buddies around as well with quantum entanglement.
Yes, so quantum entanglement is a new rule on this monster. Zor Necros, playing with all the powers of the universe here, has a gun that allows him to control gravity so he can hit something and move it. And then he has an ability called quantum entanglement that says that if he places another monster with a throw or using his gravity gun, then he or his partner can move too. And there are so many cool synergistic combos that you can do with that.
Yeah, and speaking of synergies, the other main interesting thing about Zor Necros to me is he's the first Necroscourge monster who actually gives his units something. He has two different buffs in Alpha. He's going to have a rule that's previously only been on the Protector monster Master of in the form of the Invigorate rule, which will allow the very Brawl-centric faction of the Necroscourge to potentially get a +2 boost on an attack. And then in Hyper, when you have a whole bunch of your zombies out, he becomes a mastermind, which allows you to potentially double up on that bonus boost from the Necroscourge Nexus when you're making your combined attacks. Or if you lost all your Necroscourge Nexi because it's that late in the game, hey, you've got that bonus boost back.
There's also some great synergy there with the Necros Overlord, because the Necros Overlord having Tyrant is going to make all of the Necroscourge more accurate. And so then having an extra boost dice on top of that, and then maybe the Necroscourge Nexus, you can see how letting the zombies play their game the way they want to, but letting the swarm do their thing is a bad plan. You have to have a plan for them. Fortunately, there are some pretty good counters to some of these strategies out there. We only have a few more minutes here. Marin and Brett, I'm going to give you each the opportunity to talk about a counter synergy or counter strategy to the monster you brought to the table. I think one of the best exercises I like to do as a player is to look at my list and say, now, how would I beat this? And how can I prevent that? So let's start with Brett. Brett, since you started us out with Avar and the Warden of Teokali, and we talked about how awesome this list is, all the player expression and all the player agency in the buildings and the units and how it all fits together. But what's its weakness? Where is it falling short?
Well, we kind of mentioned it earlier, the lack of a conventional 1v1.
And what does that mean?
So a conventional 1v1 is typically, we refer to that as a monster that can clear a screen and still make a power attack in the same turn. So in that late game, they can still get their throw or their body slam for the 3 damage and trade up on the damage, especially if they can then screen themselves as well or step out of alignment. It means that you'll be able to just kind of bully the other monster.
Mm-hmm. So having abilities like Swift Strike that allow you to make an extra attack and remove a unit, or abilities like Telekinesis who allow you to move units out of the way and into a better position for you, allow you to get that alignment to do those power attacks.
Yeah, and since neither of the monsters I brought have that ability inherently, like Avar has Integrate on both sides, so she can still potentially clear a screen if a rec facility is up, but I wouldn't count on that in like the late game that we're talking about here. So you can just kind of like bully the list out. Mm. And that's what I would do, especially monsters like the Queen, Hurricaneus, Zor Necros even is a conventional 1v1 monster, so he could bully this list pretty hard.
Absolutely. So Marin, from the other side of the table, if you were going into the Necro Swarm and fighting against Zor Necros, what do you do to beat it?
There's two big tools to beating the Necroscourge in general, and the first tool is Return to Reserves effects. So we're talking about Blast Radius on the Spar, which is my baby, but we're also talking more conventionally about the Abduct, Recycle, and Flak Field actions. You might want to have an AA Ape in your list, because those things will clear out zombies like nobody's business. Other major tool to protect against the Necroscourge is to have a way to prevent them from actually getting that repurpose trigger off. And the main way to do that is by having a unit that spawns another unit into play on top of itself when it's destroyed. The most famous example of this is the Meat Slave and the Lords of Cthulhu, but the new Humasoid unit gives the Protectors a way to do it too with its invasive species rule.
So why don't you touch on that real quick? Because since we didn't talk about invasive species and we kind of went over some of the other rules, what is invasive species?
Invasive species is a rule on the Humasoid that says when this model is destroyed, you can take a faction unit of the same cost or less as this model and place it into play within three spaces of this model.
So in order
to prevent the repurpose trigger, this is very funny. In order to prevent the repurpose trigger, you have to actually plant that unit, the unit that you're getting on top of where the Humasoid was. Otherwise, you can place your unit and your opponent is also going to get the repurpose trigger. But it is more flexible than the traditional incubate on the Meat Slave in that you can put the unit in a different location. However, it has that cost restriction, which means the plants actually have a lot of powerful two-cost units, but a lot of the value of the Humasoid comes in its one-cost non-elite variant. So there's some tension in your list building and whether you want to include elites or not, which is very interesting.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the Meat Slave. I think one of the rudest things you can do to a Necroscourge player is have it go from Meat Slave to Squix. Right? Because you hit them with the hard to kill body and then you drop the disruption on them and it just ruins their day.
Yeah. And I mentioned disruption and high defense as answers to the Necroscourge package as well earlier in the segment. In terms of dealing with Zor Necros himself, I've mentioned before, he doesn't have great dice. His attacks are not super accurate of their own accord. So what you can do to beat Zor Necros in particular is starve him of power dice. If he can't hit you, he can't kill you.
Absolutely. Which is why you bring Gorgadra, arguably, right? And yes. So then if your opponent has to attack Gorgadra first because they want to starve you of power, they're playing into your game. And so it's a very tough puzzle for your opponent to solve. I think one of the other ways to deal with Zor Necros is how you deal with a lot of the other more fragile monsters. You just focus on them. You go and get them where they're at. And he's one of the hardest to do because of Redshift, because Necro Shinobi offering disruption. There's so many layers to having to dislodge him from where he's at. And he's got some tricks to keep himself pocketed up. So it'll be an interesting puzzle to watch players solve as they go into this new era with the Vegetarian and Necroscourge packages.
For sure. You know, Shadow Sun Syndicate, eat your heart out. I think we've got the most classical depiction of a ninja archetype monster that we could possibly think of in this monster.
Yeah, especially a bad guy ninja, right? Like everything from Mastermind to the Sculpt, which was an absolute knock out of the park. This monster just screams like this is the big bad villain.
Yeah, he's dodgy too with using the quantum entanglement to dance away. Like, he can be tough to pin down for sure.
Well, team, I think that's all the time we have. Marin, Brett, thank you for joining me on this episode of Primecast, and I look forward to having you on again.
Yeah, it was great to be here.
Yeah,
you want to
sure.
say roll drums?
Roll drums?
Roll drums? Oh my God, we're supposed to say it out loud?
At the same
time. Sorry.
1, 2, 3.
Roll drums.
Roll drums.
Oh, terrible at this.
Just awful. Hello, everyone. In this last segment, I would like to extend a warm welcome to Jason Souls and Eric Ryerson.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm excited to have you both on today for Primecast, especially since today we're going to be talking about the Storm Legion.
It's about time.
Hype! So there's a lot to cover, and so let's just dive right in. I think first up, though, Eric, you had mentioned backstage about Anson Wolf, and can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, we've had so much we've been excited to show you guys. We've just been sitting on. You guys finally got to see Athena DeBarro. She offers a more defensive style of Warcaster. whereas Major Anson Wolf offers quite the opposite. Comes from a similar design philosophy to Stryker II. He enhances himself and his army to be quite formidable, striking hard, fast. His feet give him hell, allows members of his battle group to move and attack every time something dies. He has positive charge, and he personally has blood quenched and sidestep. It's something not too similar to what we've seen within Signar in the past, especially. And it's exciting to see that on the table now.
Blood quenched and sidestep. That is spicy.
He himself served under Archduke Runewood, actually. And when Runewood turned to the Infernals, that sort of pushed him over the edge. He had been a formidable caster previously defending Eastwall. And then once he saw people he saw as role models and backed collapse and the world failing around him, he realized he really had to step up his game. And it drove his aggression to try and drive back the enemies of the Storm Legion and Signar.
Oh, man, that little tie-in to Runewood, that's really cool. I could see a little rivalry there going. You know, what's that guy's backstory? Runewood! Jason, anything you want to add to that?
So we started off working with Anson Wolf's design, and it was a little more defensive at first. Slightly closer to the other Warcaster, Damaro. And we ended up kind of re-engineering him through playtest and making him more and more aggressive. He lost things like parry and riposte for, you know, blood quenched and sidestep. Over time, he ended up with positive charge, energizer, and lightning tendrils as his core spell outload. So he's got some real maneuverability potential to deal, especially melee harm. Yeah, he's a fun caster to play.
So aggro, and that's awesome. So, Jason, you have some spoilers to tell us about too, am I right?
Well, if you're talking about Captain Madison Calder, sure. But I'm not going to say a lot. She's another caster that we haven't introduced yet. Stormlance Scout, so she'll be a cavalry caster.
Yes!
And she's got a whole another bag of movement tricks that you don't usually see in, you know, Signar's slower, more lumbering storm armies. But I'm not sure what else I'm going to say about her. We got to save some surprises.
He said enough. Cav caster. I love Cav models. I'm all about it. That's Eric, do you have anything you want to add to talking about?
What she brings to the table instead of like that raw aggression or raw defensive power is more tricks on the table, ways to circumvent others' rules, and ways to be more evasive, and really embracing the whole outrider advanced scout role within the army. And I think she really brings a lot of like interesting counterplay and strategies that aren't necessarily present with the other two we've presented so far.
So much for keeping our cards closer to our chest.
Eric, can you tell me about Lieutenant Sarah Brisbane? Last name many of us War Machine players should be pretty familiar with.
And it's no accident. She is, in fact, Siege's daughter. And she got into military service quite young, following her father's footsteps, serving Signar. She's picked up some tricks while serving under Athena Dabaro, and she makes a pretty adequate journeyman, giving some offensive and defensive capabilities and supporting her army.
I love the character journeyman. Going all the way back to like just the unnamed journeyman and Signar being such a like key piece that everybody used, to the point where we have like Brisbane's daughter now as a journeyman. That's really exciting. I'd really like to dive into the storm theme here, because the evolution of galvanic technology is very clear and present in these. So can you take us from how it evolved from Nemo and his mad science experiments to the modern storm chambers we're seeing now?
Yeah, we saw Nemo even back to his, you know, first initial days in the escalation campaign, sort of on the edge of the wilderness, plundering convergence temples and whatever he can get his hands on to grab their tech, because he understood that there were secrets that the convergence held that Signar hadn't developed yet. So we saw Nemo active in escalation, and then immediately afterward in apotheosis, we saw the Thunderhead, which was the first real fruits of his labors.
And
as things kind of progressed and Signar sort of digested that technology and evolved it, we saw, you know, the Stormwall and all the storm tech that followed. And by Requiem, after the claiming and the events in the Henchhold Scrolls, we see the convergence truly kind of decimated. Its leadership's gone, but we also see a new era of religious tolerance in Signar as the Moroans and Damarites and even some Menites are sort of, you know, working together in common cause against the Infernals. So after those events, by Requiem, we start to see the convergence really getting integrated. The Cirrus worshippers that survived really getting integrated into Signar's technological industrial complex. Uh-huh. And between that and the arcane secrets that are coming to light as, you know, the Thamarites are sharing their libraries and such things, Signar really kind of enters a new renaissance. I mean, most of the Iron Kingdoms do, kind of the exception of Kador, which has fallen behind due to internal troubles and dissension we'll be covering later. With this new renaissance, there's a, you know, their industrial capabilities are hugely expanding, and among their accomplishments is a stable, mass-producible storm chamber, which is kind of the necessary component that we need to see the evolution that becomes a Storm Legion. Really, I guess that's it in a nutshell.
Awesome.
By nutshell, I guess I mean, you know, 500 words.
Well, it does take us across that arc. I remember when Thunderhead first came out, that was the model that got me into Signar. I went, okay, I'm buying a new faction. There it is. That's the thing. It's such a cool model. It's such a great theme. And to watch it evolve to where it is now has been really exciting. Everything from Storm Striders to seeing, I remember when the Stormwall first dropped, and it dropped like my jaw because I couldn't believe how cool that model was. Also that it had giant galvanic coils and lightning pods. I was like, all right, Signar has like really upped their game, their technology levels.
Even way back when we dropped the Thunderhead, we knew that was a prototype. We knew that we'd be seeing an increase in storm tech, and we knew one day we would see fully galvanic warjacks that no longer had steam boilers built into them.
Hmm.
Whole steam engines.
Jason, one of the most talked about pieces that we've seen so far has been the horse-drawn carriage. Can you tell me a little bit more about that model's design and concept? Why horses? Why did they choose this?
So the Zephyr was always designed as a chariot. It's fast, maneuverable. It's operatable by one dude. So it seems like the perfect tool. It's what they wanted.
Great. I really love Storm Legion. When I first got into Signar, Storm Tech is why I bought in, and it's why I stayed, and it's why I'm back, baby. So I'm excited for it all over again. That wraps us up for Primecast. I'm your host, Emmanuel Class. Tune in next month for more exciting interviews and hangouts. You never know who's going to show up next. Stay tuned in to Privateer Press media channels for what you might get to see. Thanks for listening to Primecast, the official Privateer Press podcast.